The former British Prime Minister says the Ukraine war is an indication of the West's diminishing dominance. Tony Blair stated that the West's dominance is coming to an end as China rises to superpower status in partnership with Russia at one of the most significant inflection points in centuries.
The collective West needs to take into account now is that they are not alone. They need to stop their imperialistic way of approaching how they see the world. They tend to say, well, the global worlds, but when they say the global world, they only mean maybe 15% of the population. But the problem now is that they don't have the weight they used to have, and they need to take into account that you have an emerging world, and we are living the last days of the imperialistic West.
From trade wars against China to sanctions on many countries, including Russia, Iran, and Venezuela, the West has in the past decade went on a rampage against any nation not willing to play by its rules. But now, the West's risky games have backfired, and signs of distress are multiplying, with falling currency valuation, social crisis, inflation, poverty, and much more. Those coercive measures also, however, push targeted nations closer to each other, setting the foundations of a multilateral world. In the 1960s, while the US was putting a man on the moon, China was struggling to feed its 1 billion people during the decade-long Cultural Revolution. The US was enjoying a favorable economic environment, and China, on the other hand, was faced with a completely stagnant and ruined economy coupled with widespread famine. But nearly two decades later, in light of vast economic reforms, China opened up to private businesses and foreign investment. Dominant state-owned bank turned savings into financing tools for roads, rail links, and ports, all this while foreign firms were forced to set up alongside a local partner, encouraging the transfer of technology. As a result, the economy grew 90-fold over the next four decades. But history clearly shows that plagues and wars are things that either cause the downfalls of particular order or cause a rethink. So when these disasters arise, a void is created waiting to be filled by a superior nation or nations.
I think it's not about, you know, either one pole or the other. You know, we might enter into a bipolar world or ideally a multipolar world. It doesn't mean that it's going to be a complete downfall. You know, the world needs the West. It's not about either or. It is about how we can live together. But if the West keeps on going into this direction, it might be a downfall, especially when you look at the economy. How are they going to manage when the dollar is not going to be the global currency? Now the dollar being a global currency makes the U.S., gives the U.S. this power to print endless paper, which is backed by nothing. So that's, if we talk about downfall, well, we might have an economic downfall, because the day that the dollar is no more the global currency, hegemonic currency, then you then will experience hyperinflation, and it could be extremely dramatic.
In the past couple of years, not only China, but several sovereign nations, including Russia and Iran, demonstrated the power which can be gained through sovereignty. And countries relying on the West, on the other hand, presented an example of the problems that could arise upon relying on others. From the formation of new allegiances such as the BRICS or the G20 to a shift away from a unipolar world and dependency on the US, all signs indicate a shift in global order towards a multilateral world. Gas supplies to Europe have tightened and fuel costs have soared since Russia's conflict with Ukraine in February and subsequent sanctions, leaving countries scrambling to refill storage and diversify supply channels. But despite the heavy costs incurred by their citizens, the Russophobia sentiment by many EU countries, especially those with close ties with the US, continues unabated. The Netherlands, Germany, Poland, and Italy are just some of the European countries who are buyers of Russian oil. But now the EU seems to have imposed sanctions on Moscow without having a plan for life without cheap Russian energy. A clear example of sanctions backfiring would be Germany, which recently reported its first trade deficit in 30 years. While the sanctions on Russia were meant to pressure Moscow in light of its special operation in Ukraine, the backfiring of the EU measures have given birth to disagreements between politicians in the bloc. The Hungarian Prime Minister has said that a failure in rolling back the sanctions on Russia risks the destruction of the European economy. Viktor Orban said European leaders should reconsider their strategy, as sanctions have caused widespread damage to the European economy without weakening Russia or bringing the months-long war closer to any resolution.
Absolutely. I think that the Hungarian leader, Viktor Orban, right now is saying what is meant to be unsaid and unspoken, is that basically the sanctions, this pressure campaign from the European Union against Russia because of Russia's special military operation in Ukraine is having a blowback, as the CIA used to put the term, in that the sanctions are actually working against the European economy. And what Orban was addressing was the fuel crisis that exists right now, compounded with the inflation that we see around the world. We're looking at fuel prices increasing, fuel shortages, and issues with fuel supply and logistics to get that fuel to the European market and to many of the nations. Remember that Hungary is landlocked, so it imports most of its oil via pipeline. And so right now we are witnessing a pretty catastrophic next few months and what some people are predicting to be a very tough winter for Europe.
In 2021, the EU imported around 155 billion cubic meters of natural gas from Russia. The bloc's proposed gas replacements by the end of 2022, which included LNG diversification, renewables, heating efficiency, pipeline diversification, biomethane, solar rooftops, and heat pumps, however, only amount to around 102 BCM annually. The European Commission and member states' efforts to diversify away from Russian fossil fuels were also clearly demonstrated in a memorandum of understanding with Egypt and Israel for LNG exports from the East Mediterranean. However, analysts predicted that there could be significant cost implications for Europe as it looks elsewhere for gas supplies. The International Monetary Fund even indicated that escalations to existing sanctions against Russia could cascade into even steeper energy price increases, deteriorating corporate and household sentiment and financial market disruption.
The European leaders don't really care about their people, and they don't really care about peace. They are interested in serving the military-industrial complex. They're interested, as members of the ruling class, in serving the lapdogs, in Washington, in Brussels, in Vienna. And so they don't really care, ultimately, about peace and stability. Ukraine here is like a sacrificial lamb for the European leaders by which to pump in more weapons. Germany is rearming itself. NATO is going to increase its weapons. And we see, not only in Europe now, but everywhere, sanctions affect the poorest people. They affect the population. They don't as necessarily affect the leaders.
Spiraling inflation has been eating into the salaries of lower-income Europeans, and this has triggered protests and strikes across the continent over the rising cost of living. From railway workers to pilots, people from all walks of life dissatisfied with the situation have in one way or another expressed their concerns. Now, farmers in Spain have also joined the mass European protests seen in Italy, Poland, and the Netherlands. The farmers' protests seen in Spain, Poland, and Italy come after strikes in the Netherlands have led to many supermarkets running out of food as the anti-government movement continues. The rising cost of fuel has also been a contributing factor to the protests.
in the limelight.
The clear message here is that the Israeli regime may target Palestinian children as it pleases, as there will be no legal, political, or moral accountability for its actions, says Ramzi Baru, journalist, in an article published under the heading, "The UN is Failing Palestinian Victims." Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. We regret we failed to protect you. This was part of a statement issued by United Nations human rights experts on July 14th, urging the Zionist regime to release Palestinian prisoner Ahmad Manasra, only 13 years old at the time of his arrest and torture by Israeli regime forces. Manasra is now 20 years old. His case is a representation of the Zionist regime's overall inhumane treatment of Palestinian children. The expert's statement was forceful and heartfelt. It accused the Zionist regime of depriving young Manasra of his childhood, family environment, protection, and all the rights he should have been guaranteed as a child. It referred to the case as hunting, considering Manasra's deteriorating mental conditions. The statement went further, declaring that this case is a stain on all of us as part of the international human rights community. Condemning the Zionist regime for its ill treatment of Palestinian children, whether those under siege in war-stricken Gaza or under military occupation and apartheid in the rest of the occupied territories in the West Bank and East Al-Quds, is commonplace. Yet somehow the Zionist regime was still spared a spot on the unflattering list issued annually by the United Nations Secretary General, naming and shaming governments and groups that commit grave violations against children and minors anywhere in the world. Oddly, the report does recognize the Zionist regime's horrific record of violating children's rights in Palestine. It details some of these violations, which UN workers have directly verified. This includes 2,934 grave violations against 1,208 Palestinian children in the year 2021 alone. However, the report equates between the Zionist regime's record, one of the most dismal in the world, and that of other parts of the world. Though the deliberate harming of a single child is regrettable regardless of the circumstances or the perpetrator, it is mind-boggling that the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres found it appropriate to equate the systematic violations carried out by the Zionist regime's military as a matter of course and the violations in other parts of the world. Worse, Guterres' report went further to reassure the Israelis that they are on the right track by stating that so far this year we have not witnessed a similar number of violations, as if to suggest that the right-wing Israeli cabinet of Naftali Bennett and Yair Lapid has purposely changed its policies regarding the targeting of Palestinian children. Of course, there is no evidence of this whatsoever. On June 27th, Defense for Children International Palestine, DCIP, reported that the Zionist regime had been intensifying its aggression against children in the West Bank and East Al-Quds since the beginning of 2022. DCIP confirmed that as many as 15 Palestinian children were killed by Israeli regime forces in the first 6 months of 2022, almost the same killed in other regions in the previous years. This number includes 5 children in the occupied city of Jenin alone. The Zionist regime even targeted journalists who attempt to report on these violations, including Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Aghaleh, who was killed on May 11th, and Ali Samoudi, who was shot in the back on the very same day. Much more can be said, of course, about the besiegement of hundreds of thousands of Palestinian children in the Gaza Strip, known as the world's largest open-air prison, and many more in the occupied West Bank. The lack of basic human rights, including life-saving medicine and, in the case of Gaza, clean water, hardly suggests any measurable improvement in the Zionist regime's track record as far as Palestinian children's rights are concerned. If you think that the UN report is a step in the right direction, think again. 2014 was one of the most tragic years for Palestinian children where, according to a previous UN report, 557 children were killed and 4,249 were injured, the vast majority of whom were targeted during the Israeli regime war on Gaza. Human Rights Watch stated that the number of killed Palestinians was the third highest in the world that year. Still, Israeli regime was not blacklisted on the UN list of shame. The clear message here is that the Israeli regime may target Palestinian children as it pleases, as there will be no legal, political, or moral accountability for its actions. This is not what Palestinians are expecting from the United Nations, an organization that supposedly exists to end armed conflicts and bring peace and security for all. For now, the message emanating from the world's largest international institution to Menasra and the rest of Palestine's children will remain unchanged. We regret, we failed to protect you.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Welcome back to Aperture. We witnessed the spectacular and awe-inspiring natural beauty of the Kaluts or Yardangs in the western part of Dashtalut in Iran. Rising up to 80 meters, these streamlined ridges have been carved by the wind out of the clay and sand lining the desert floor, creating a magnificent array of high-rising sculptures and lying parallel to the prevailing winds. The Yardangs are some of the world's most prominent. Stay with us as we follow Javad Gharayi, an Iranian nature explorer and documentary filmmaker, as he introduces more of Iran's desert wonders to us.
Early the next morning, I was still sleepy and tired, but some of the most beautiful natural views revealed themselves in the moments before sunrise. The cold and the dark couldn't stop me from exploring the natural beauties near my camp. The early hours of morning in the natural world fills you with energy. Filled to the brim with that energy that emanates from the peace and tranquility bestowed upon this land by God Almighty, I started my day that promised to be a good one. I spent 3 hours exploring the areas around my tent, taking beautiful photos of the unmatched scenery of the Kaluts, a precious gift by Mother Nature to those who appreciate her. It was time for me to leave the imaginary city of Kaluts, a city with great potential for becoming a destination for responsible tourists and nature travelers. The most beautiful natural scenes should either be visited in the early hours of morning or sometime around sundown. I got up at 6 o'clock this morning and was able to take spectacular snaps of the natural beauties around here with this very camera. I have to say, I love Iran with all my being because of its very rich culture and its remarkably diverse natural beauties. It's time to go now. I have to pack up. I gotta put my tent back into my backpack and head out for the Kaluts again. This is my last day here. I can't stay here much longer because I'm running out of food and water. Not only the Kaluts, but the entire vast Lut region are considered as an invaluable natural museum in the world. All by itself, the Lut Desert is home to a world of numerous beauties, the like of which are scattered in different places across our planet. Without a doubt, it's among the most beautiful deserts on Earth. The Yalon mega dunes with their rare views, the Kaluts, the star-shaped dunes, the beautiful valleys in the heart of Lut, the hottest part of Dashtalut, which is Gandum Merian, a large plateau covered in dark lava, the unique vegetation, including small trees named Saxols, the Martian or miniature mountains on the fringes of Lut, the central hole, the Dolphin Valley comprised of rock formations eroded by wind, Dashtakashk, and the plant and animal species endemic to Lut. Add to all that the villages with their unique desert architecture, people whose cultures go back 6,000 years. My GPS is telling me I've walked around 36 kilometers through the Kaluts. This is nearly the end of my trek into the Kaluts. Another very beautiful feature of the Kaluts of Kerman, in other words, the Kaluts of Shahdad, is the Nepka Forest Park. These very beautiful plants you see behind me here are in fact the trees that have formed this Nepka Forest Park. Only two species, salt cedars and saxols, which have grown here and created this beautiful and unique landscape. This area obviously looks different from others. The Nepka's Forest Park forms the vegetation on the fringe of the Kalut area. But this green patch fades away as you move from the cold mountains of Sirj to the hot, dry Kaluts. And in the heart of the Kaluts, there is hardly any vegetation at all. But Mother Nature has created a matchless forest in the area between the Sears Mountains and the Calus. This strange land formation I'm standing next to is not your simple hill. It is the world's biggest natural vase known as the Nepca. This phenomenon is called Nepca in the African Sahara, Shur Moro in the central areas of Iran, and Talagaz by those living on the eastern and southeastern plains of Iran. When sandstorms blow past the vegetation in this area, they leave behind some of the dirt and sand at the foot of these plants. When the wind blows, some of the sand and dirt is trapped in the trees and crashes to the ground, creating a mound over time. In order to survive, the trees use their long roots to absorb water and other nutrients buried underground. The dirt around the shrubs and trees contain more moisture. This relative moisture keeps the sand and earth in place around the plant. Of course, that leads to a portion of the trunk, branches, and leaves being buried, which in turn contributes to the solidification of the sand near the plant. Every natural Nepca vase is named according to the species it hosts. The Nepcas are called Talagaz or Talitar by the locals in this region. Another unique feature of Lute are these same Nepcas. They are the tallest natural vases in the world. The Nepcas of this kind have been seen in Africa too, but the ones in Africa are barely 3 meters tall. At their tallest, the Nepcas in Iran are 10 meters tall. Normally, Nepcas grow on flat surfaces. They best grow on moist land. The shape of the Nepca depends on the size, density, and growth rate of the host plant. In this Nepca forest, the dominant species is the salt cedar. My goodness, it looks more like a miracle. Just look how God instilled the hope for life in these salt cedars and saxols. When they're just small seedlings, winds dump massive amounts of sand onto them. But driven by their strong will to live, they continue to grow in order to survive. The battle between the wind and sand on one hand and these trees on the other has been going on forever. It's been around for millions of years. But what is really very important is that hope keeps everything and everyone alive. And these trees, because of their intrinsic sense of hope, the will for life, put their roots down and stand tall. They continue to grow as a means of survival. It's going to become stormy very soon. Desert storms are very dangerous. So what you need to do is find shelter somewhere or leave that area immediately. Fortunately, I'm very close to my next destination and I think I'm not going to run into any trouble. But I have to get going immediately or I'm going to get sand and dirt all over my body and stuff. My camera crew and I were taken off guard by the sudden change of weather and the subsequent sandstorm. One of the biggest powers of nature in a desert is the ability of sand and dust to penetrate each and every orifice during a storm, and our equipment was no exception. Sandstorms are among the biggest dangers of a desert. In some cases, such storms continue to blow for days and can cost nature travelers their lives. But there are other dangers lurking in other parts of this vast plain. Therefore, the best way to ensure a safe trip to Lute is to make the necessary arrangements with the relevant authorities in Kerman province and the city of Shahdad. From Shahdad, I had to walk around 250 kilometers to the west of the province, to a place only 15 kilometers away from Rafsanjan. Kerman is a province with limited water resources. Many of the deep wells in the province have dried up. But deep in the heart of Rafsanjan's crisis-hit nature, there is a canyon that sparkles like a diamond. You might be thinking this isn't Iran, that I'm speaking to you from another country. But you're wrong. This is our beloved Iran, and I'm now standing atop a scary deep canyon, the Raga Grand Canyon of Rafsanjan. Valleys and canyons are strange yet beautiful natural phenomena, and they become even more beautiful if their emergence is not the result of orogeny, rather if it's the result of thousands or millions of years of erosion by wind, sand, and water of flat plains. Raga Grand Canyon is one such ravine, a peerless, pristine valley in Kerman province. I was amazed at the view of the canyon from above. The pointed cones, the big and small columns carved out by erosion, the arcs, the partitions and wall-like strips were only a few of all the beautiful features of this canyon. Raga is around 20 kilometers long. Its width varies between 3 and 100 kilometers, and in some places it is around 80 meters deep. Walking on top of it could have been very dangerous. My goodness, it's really scary, but it's magnificent at the same time. At this point, I think it's around 70 meters deep from where I'm standing. If I fall into it, there will be nothing left of me. It's dangerous to be here because the earth here is very soft and can slide at any moment. So you'll have to keep a safe distance while walking along these beautiful walls. It's ruggedly beautiful indeed. You can get the most beautiful view of the canyon from up here, but every side of it offers its own unique beauty. What I'm really happy about is the fact that there is no construction work happening anywhere in a 20-kilometer radius. There are no roads. That's why this ravine has maintained its pristine status, and of course, the area around it too. My hope is that we can preserve this untouched ravine and its surroundings the way they are and leave them to the next generation, and they to the generation that comes after them, just like the way it looks now. I hope so. The canyon's geomorphology and its pristine environs made for beautiful scenery, and that had provided a good habitat for certain species of animals in and around it. This region and this gorge are so intact, they've become home to various species of birds, such as eagles that have built their nests in recesses high on the walls where they feel safe. I'm very excited and counting every minute for the walk on the bed of the canyon, but the best time to do it would be tomorrow because I don't have enough time for it today. Raga Canyon is a good destination for geologists and nature travelers venturing into the Lute. The vegetation, such as salt cedar trees in some parts of the canyon, made the canyon even more beautiful. From the bottom up, ravines look just as beautiful. I walked along much of Raga Canyon from above and captured many beautiful views of it, but it was now time to go down to the bottom of it. This part of the wall is solid. It's hard to walk on. It's very steep too, as you can see. You have to take a lot of care going down.
My God, yes.
At the bottom, the canyon was beautiful and scary. I kept thinking its walls were going to come crashing down any minute. Walking at the foot of those majestic walls, I felt how little and weak I was compared to the canyon and to its creator. On one hand, the beautiful long natural statues, and on the other, the tunnel-shaped arcs carved into the walls were all astonishing. Statues chiseled by gravity pulling down the dirt and pebbles on the walls of the ravine. The view down here is simply breathtaking. The huge, majestic statues carved out on the walls of the canyon have taken thousands of years to be made. As loose earth from the top of the canyon cascaded down to the bottom over the years, it created these beautiful shapes on these walls. They are stunning. Some of them look like humans and others like certain animals. This canyon is just as beautiful down on its bed as it is from above. This dry tree over here, in fact, there are many others scattered across the ravine. Floodwaters on the highlands and on the plains sweep them up along with some of the trees that grow at the mouth of the canyon in spring and dump them over here. It's a bizarre scene here. It's very dangerous to come here in the spring season because floodwaters are deadly. Ravine exploration is among the most interesting fields in nature traveling. There are many adventurers around the world who are in love with exploring valleys and canyons. But this field of sport comes with its own hidden dangers. The collapse of the walls or falling from the edge of a canyon's walls are among those dangers. But there's another more serious threat to the life of nature travelers, which is seasonal floodwaters caused by rainfall. Just take a look at what seasonal rivers have done to these walls. The water can be around 2 meters deep here at the time of a flood and can be fatal. Whenever I travel to a place like this, I study up on its weather and climate before I set out so I won't run into any trouble. So when it's raining, you better not be anywhere near the bottom of any ravine. Although Raga Canyon is very wide and the floodwaters flowing in pose a less serious threat,
it is likely for torrential rain to come down in the nearby areas. And that means flash floods at a certain time during a day or night or a whole day. So at a time like that, you better not come here. Most nature travelers take all kinds of precautions prior to their adventure. But most of them don't pay much attention to the climate of the places they travel to. They don't take the weather forecasts very seriously. In 2005, 11 mountaineers from Ghazvin, with all their equipment and years of experience, entered Andres Canyon in Alborz province. But because they had ignored the weather forecast and the predicted rain, they had an accident. During rainfalls, valleys and canyons that offer no escapes are the most dangerous places in the natural world to be. In that year, heavy rain set off floodwaters in Andres Canyon, and unfortunately, it took the lives of all 11 mountaineers. Therefore, the most important thing that natural explorers should take into account is the weather forecast, the difficulty of the route they're traveling on, and their mental and physical strength for the trip ahead. You can't put a price tag on the environment. All those who walk into nature speak of it as a cathartic experience and absorb massive amounts of positive energy. In my opinion, because the natural world is a manifestation of the greatness and beauty of God, I have walked a very long distance. I'm about to arrive at the end of the canyon. I'm going to have to get out of it before dark sets in, concluding another leg of my trip. It's very easy to pollute your environment, but that's not right. It only goes to show how irresponsible we humans can be. We have to take responsibility for the environment in our country and in the entire planet. We mustn't dump our garbage out in the open and instead send it to the recycling system. We must treat nature the same way we do our homes. Only then can we say we are committed to other humans, to the planet Earth, and to future generations. I'm approaching the end of my trip. I have no doubt that many of my countrymen and women are not familiar with the beautiful natural wonders of Kerman province. And many of the officials in the province don't seem to be aware of the great potential these natural wonders have as tourist destinations. In addition to its old history and culture, the province boasts unique natural features on a par with their counterparts in the rest of the world. In the developed world, development doesn't include building roads, hotels, and tourism centers in the heart of the environment. In the century we live in, development and progress is tantamount to the unconditional and responsible preservation of the environment, and sustainable development of the tourism industry can easily set in motion the big wheels of the country's economy. The environment in Iran is very fragile and sensitive, but with proper professional preservation and protection, by people and officials alike, it can turn into a big generator of jobs and revenues, provided that we appreciate what we have and do all we can to preserve what's left of Iran's untapped natural world. We should perish the thought of construction on it.
I'm sure you'll agree with me that Iran's deserts, with their varied and dramatic landscapes of canyons, yardangs, and their beautiful flora and fauna, are a unique destination for the demanding traveler to discover a wealth of exceptional and unspoiled views. And that's it for this week. Do keep in touch with us, and until next week, goodbye.
In the limelight.
Congressional Committee has heard former U.S. President Donald Trump pressured his Vice President Mike Pence to overturn the 2020 election, despite having been told repeatedly that doing so would be illegal. We are prepared for an article written jointly by Patricia Zengerler and Richard Cowan. The piece is titled U.S. House Panel Hears Trump Pressured Pence to Overturn His 2020 Election Defeat. Aides to Mike Pence told the Congressional Committee investigating the 6th of January 2021 protest march on the Capitol, when thousands of people marched against the certification of the November 2020 election, which placed Joe Biden in office as the current U.S. president, former U.S. President Donald Trump pressured his vice president to overturn his 2020 election defeat. According to a Reuters news agency, members of the Democratic-led House of Representatives Select Committee said recently that Trump continued his pressure campaign despite being told repeatedly it was illegal to do so, as Mike Pence and lawmakers met to formally certify Joe Biden's victory. The 9-member Select Committee's public hearings, launched recently, intends to put up a case against Donald Trump that he was responsible for the 6th of January 2021 violence, starting with knowingly spreading lies around the election, seeking to overturn the election results, assembling the mob in the Capitol, and failing to act to stop the violence. The committee is trying to build a case that Trump's efforts to overturn his defeat amounted to illegal conduct, far beyond normal politics. Mike Pence has criticized Trump's earlier complaints about his handling of the 6th of January joint session, which, as a part of the regular legal process of validating presidential elections, was convened to certify the legitimacy of the Electoral College votes of the various states. Donald Trump has repeatedly denied wrongdoing while maintaining that he lost the election only because of widespread fraud that benefited the Democrat Joe Biden. Trump and his supporters denounced the 6th of January panel as a political witch hunt. Trump claimed that he won the 2020 presidential election and that there was massive voter fraud. The former president claimed that he ordered 10,000 National Guard troops to protect the Capitol building. The certification vote on 6th of January 2021 had become a focus for Donald Trump. On 6th of January 2021, Trump supporters occupied the U.S. Capitol while lawmakers were in the process of reviewing the certification of state electors, which indicated Joe Biden's victory. Some Trump supporters had hoped that this process could have resulted in some of the electors being disqualified, thus overturning the outcome of the presidential election. It is claimed by some that the demonstrators were infiltrated and incited by provocateurs from U.S. intelligence agencies who orchestrated the false flag operation in order to get rid of Donald Trump. Some among the crowd clashed with police officers and some made threats to beat up a number of Democratic lawmakers. Some also inflicted damage on parts of the Capitol building. Mark Short, who was Mike Pence's chief of staff, claimed in videotape testimony that Pence told Trump many times that he did not have the authority to stop the vote certification in Congress. Gregory Jacob, an attorney for Mike Pence, said the main proponent of that theory, attorney John Eastman, admitted in front of the president 2 days before the January 6 attack on the Capitol that his plan to have Mike Pence halt the procedure would violate the law. John Eastman had argued that Mike Pence could reject results from certain states if he thought they were illegitimate, giving Republicans in those states an opportunity to declare Donald Trump the victor despite the actual vote count. Advisors to Mike Pence told the committee that the idea had no basis in law. We'll be right back. Former U.S. Appeals Court Judge J. Michael Luttig, an informal Mike Pence advisor, said it is breathtaking that these arguments even were conceived, let alone entertained by the President of the United States. Committee members and witnesses warned that Donald Trump, who is widely expected to run for president again in 2024, would not accept defeat no matter the actual outcome. Former U.S. Appeals Court Judge Michael Luttig said, "Today, almost 2 years after a fateful day in January of 2021, that still Donald Trump and his allies and supporters are a clear and present danger to American democracy." The committee showed several chilling clips of some of the thousands of Trump supporters who descended on the Capitol building, chanting for Mike Pence to be pulled out of the building or hanged. Trump tweeted at 24 minutes past 2 in the afternoon local time, while the protest was going on, that Mike Pence did not have the courage to stop the vote count. Sarah Matthews, a Trump White House staffer, said in a video testimony it felt like he was pouring gasoline on the fire by tweeting that. Donald Trump accused Mike Pence of having acted as an automatic conveyor belt for the old crow, Mitch McConnell, to get Biden elected president as quickly as possible. He was referring to the fact that when the proceedings were interrupted for more than 10 hours by the breach of the Capitol, the detailed challenges that many expected would be presented of fraud, ballot stuffing, and violations of Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution in Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin were given short shrift in deference to what a number of senior congressional officials termed the assault on American democracy, represented by what was already being called, both in Congress and on television, the insurrection. Donald Trump maintains that rather than allowing the proceedings to descend into an emotional morass which prejudiced the outcome and dismissed the many valid issues raised about the election without a proper hearing, Mike Pence should have provided an atmosphere for those many members of both houses who had announced their intention to bring the challengers to do so in a professional and secure environment with confidence that the proceedings would be conducted in a fair and objective manner. Mike Pence answered Donald Trump's criticism by saying that he had no right to overturn the results of the presidential election. Speaking to the Conservative Federalist Society in early February, the former vice president said some Republicans believe that as the presiding officer over the joint session of Congress, I possess unilateral authority to reject Electoral College votes. And I heard recently President Trump said I had the right to overturn the election. President Trump is wrong. I had no right to overturn the election. Although Trump had used the words overturn the election in a public statement, he was referring to the challenges to the vote counts that many expected would be presented in the half dozen or so swing states referenced earlier. These included a constitutional challenge arising as a consequence of various procedural changes which had been made in the months leading up to the election, and which allowed several million voters to use mail-in ballots for the first time. The joint session, that is, the convening of both houses of Congress in one session, is held on 6th of January following the presidential elections. The House and the Senate jointly convene, and the Electoral College results of each state are presented in the alphabetical order of the names of the individual states for certification by the Vice President, who presides over the proceedings. As the vote counts are presented, the Vice President asks the assembled Congress if there are any objections to the certification of that state's vote. If there are no objections, the certification is presumptively granted. However, if an objection is raised by a member of the House, and if it is joined by a member of the Senate, then the two houses retire to their respective chambers, where the challenge is presented in the form of a trial. If each house sustains the objection, the vote is denied certification and is not counted in the totals. There had been allegations raised in a number of the swing states, including Pennsylvania, Georgia, Wisconsin, Michigan, Arizona, and Nevada, of various types of outright fraud. There was also a claim, a strong one, that for some reason no court had touched the merits of, alleging that recent changes in election practice were done without enabling legislation by the state legislatures, and that therefore the votes that followed from these changes, including a huge and decisive number of newly authorized mail-in ballots, were void, as being in violation of Article 2, Section 1 of the U.S. Constitution. That section says, each state shall appoint, in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct, a number of electors. If those challenges prevailed, there were enough votes in enough swing states which fell into the latter category to hand the election to Donald Trump. The first challenge was raised prior to the Capitol breach in the third state to be offered for certification, that is Arizona. This prompted the two houses to retire to their individual chambers to examine the evidence supporting the claims of irregularity that were to be raised. It was when these sessions were convened that the Capitol's security was breached and portions of the building were temporarily occupied. Each of the Senate and the House sessions bore the heavy imprint of the protesters' intrusion, and much of the debate was focused not on the facts and law relevant to the claim, but instead on what was already being termed the insurgency. Upon the return of the joint session, most of the remaining challenges were deferred in favor of a showing of unity against the Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer, a day of infamy newly added to a short list that included Pearl Harbor and 9/11, where the temple to democracy was desecrated. Had the challenges in two or three of the six swing states been sustained, the outcome of the election would have been changed in favor of Donald Trump.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The notorious Ukrainian website Mirot Verets, meaning peacemaker. It publishes the names and addresses of those it deems to be enemies of Ukraine. The opening page shows pictures of dead Russian soldiers. On the list are domestic and foreign journalists, politicians and citizens that in some way they view to have aided or worked with pro-Russian forces in the country. Now, shamefully, they are adding children to the list. Faina Sevenkova, she is 13 years old and has been writing about her experiences here in Donbass. After her name appeared on the list, she started to receive threats of physical violence online.
Are you worried about being on the website? Are you concerned that something might happen to you?
Yes, of course. A person